What time is it? It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Cable TV and streaming TV are in lockstep raising their monthly rates. You would think the cable companies got a big break last week as the major streaming services raised their monthly rates to $65 a month. The savings gap got smaller and may cause subscribers to think twice before cord cutting. So what did Charter or Spectrum do? Charter raised their cable subscription prices. Charter is raising its broadcast TV fee to $16.45 a month, almost double the $8.85 that was in place in October of 2018. While many disputes are over cable channels, there have also been quite a few over local broadcast network affiliates in the past few years. Those affiliates are available over the air to people who have a digital antenna, but many of their viewers watch them via their inclusion in cable, satellite or streaming TV packages, and they charge pay TV providers a per-subscriber fee similar to what cable networks do for those retransmission costs. Many of those fees to the providers have increased over the last few years, and that time span has also seen many of the providers charging their subscribers more in broadcast TV fees, citing increased costs from providers. A particularly notable example comes from Charter Spectrum, which is yet again raising that fee. Charter Spectrum had a broadcast TV fee of $8.85 per subscriber per month as recently as October 2018. This was boosted to $9.95 in November and then to $11.99 in March 2019. It went up to $13.95 in October of 2019, and now Charter is set to boost it again, this time to $16.45 a month, beginning in August, impacting both cable and streaming TV subscribers. The broadcast TV fee surcharge will increase $2.95 a month to an unprecedented $16.45 a month. Spectrum claims this fee covers the retransmission costs local broadcasters charge the cable company to carry their channels on the cable system. Spectrum breaks this fee out of the monthly cost of cable TV and places it as a separate line item on your bill. This also conveniently allows the company to pass through rate increases even if you're on a price-locked promotional pricing package typically offered to new customers. If you do not subscribe to traditional cable TV but have signed up for one of Spectrum's streaming TV packages like TV Choice, the broadcast TV fee will also increase $2.95 a month, raising their surcharge to $8.95 a month. Spectrum also plans to increase the cost of its cable TV packages. Spectrum's most popular TV Select package is expected to increase $1.50 a month to $73.99 a month. Customers on a promotional pricing plan will not see this rate increase until their promotional pricing expires. Customers bundling multiple products should expect discounts to reduce that cost a bit. A Charter spokesperson confirmed the broadcast TV and TV Select price increases. the broadcast TV fee change will apparently apply even to customers who are on promotional deals that have a lock-in price for a set amount of time. Considering the quality of the content material on TV, I guess I'm going back to reading a book. Live TV streaming services that cost $20 or less. The major streaming services jacked up their prices and added channels that you didn't request. We know it can sometimes feel like the perfect live TV streaming service just isn't out there. There are so many services out there that offers this, but not that, and are missing the one thing that would make them perfect for you. Perhaps the biggest thing that cord cutters base their purchasing decision on is cost. There are TV streaming services that cost $20 or less and may have the channels you want. There's Epix Now, that's E-P-I-X, Now, and for $5.99 a month, that's $5.99 a month, you can stream new content from Epix channel affiliates with the service. Epix Now has become a popular alternative for cord cutters who want to access Epix programming without a cable bill. Cord cutters should know Epix Now is considered one of the more limited live TV streaming services, as it only offers you 4 channels from their published list of what channels are offered. There is CBS All Access for $5.99 a month or $9.99 a month. You can watch 12,000 plus episodes of CBS and Viacom shows with the service. You'll also have access to the CBS affiliate channel in your area to watch local TV programming as well. Cord cutters should know that the live TV functionality of the service is only available in select locations. The service also offers an ad-free version for subscribers. There's also now Frndly TV, spelled a little differently, F-R-N-D-L-Y, Frndly TV, for $5.99 a month to $9.99 per month. You can watch your favorite Hallmark shows and movies with the service. Frndly TV brands itself as a streaming service for families, and the channels it offers are appropriate for all audiences. Cord cutters should know Frndly TV is considered one of the more limited live TV streaming services, as it only offers 15 channels. The service also offers an ad-free version for subscribers. Spectrum TV Essentials, for $14.99 a month, you can stream 60 entertainment, lifestyle, and news channels with the service. It's got something for just about everyone, with a channel lineup containing everything from Nickelodeon to Bloomberg TV. Cord cutters should know this service does not include many sports channels. And finally, there's Philo TV, that's P-H-I-L-O TV. For $20 a month, you can enjoy 60 channels and unlimited DVR with this service. Philo TV offers subscribers the option to upgrade their subscription with different add-ons and features. The service is currently offering a 7-day free trial for new subscribers as well. There are tons of live TV streaming services out there, but only a few will fit your price point. Bringing high-speed internet to rural areas. Just last week, Marty Winston and I were discussing how the coronavirus pandemic had highlighted the need to have high-speed internet in rural communities. Online learning with inadequate internet support needs to be addressed. Lana Lakes and 48 others formed a coalition to bring high-speed internet to rural areas. 49 organizations across a diverse set of industries formed a coalition to close the gap in America's digital divide. Lana Lakes spearheaded the venture, recruiting companies like Hershey, Nestle, Cargill, Bayer U.S., and Microsoft to form the American Connection Project Broadband Coalition, ACPBC. That's a mouthful. The coalition's goal is to connect and uplift all American communities by providing access to modern digital technology, namely high-speed internet. the group will advocate for public and private sector investments to bring these amenities, especially to rural areas, while promoting and contributing to the options for remote education and health services, jobs, and more. The president and CEO of Lana Lakes said all too often, farmers, business owners, and even school children are disadvantaged by being on the wrong side of our country's digital divide, a problem that has become more acute as we deal with the challenges of COVID-19. But this just isn't a rural problem. The American Connection Project Broadband Coalition represents a mix of companies from tech, healthcare, agriculture, and more who understand the ramifications of our country's broken internet infrastructure and who have the willingness and expertise to help address this need. We are so grateful, they said, to have as partners who recognize that connecting all Americans is possible and who are willing to work to close our country's digital divide and invest in our collective future. The coalition has already started to act on its mission. In April of this year, the yet-to-be-formed ACPBC contacted all 50 U.S. governors, petitioning them to support the initiative and to do their part with creating solutions for more accessible high-speed connections in rural areas and to advocate for more telehealth options. The coalition urged Congress to enact groundbreaking broadband connectivity legislation that includes the necessary resources to close the digital divide in the country. As we look to help our nation recover from this global pandemic, we need to make a smart investment in the future competitiveness of this country and ensure that all Americans in both rural and urban areas are able to access the internet. Mozilla suspends Firefox Send service while it addresses malware abuse. Mozilla has temporarily suspended the Firefox Send file sharing service while it adds a report abuse mechanism. Mozilla has temporarily suspended the Firefox Send file sharing service as the organization investigates reports of abuse from malware operators and while it adds a report abuse button. The browser maker took down the service with increasing prevalence in current malware operations. Mozilla launched Firefox Send in March of last year, and the service provides secure and private file hosting and file sharing capabilities for Firefox users. Despite its name, the service is in reality accessible for anyone accessing the sendfirefox.com web portal. All files uploaded and shared through Firefox Send are stored in an encrypted format, and users can configure the amount of time the file is saved on the server and the number of downloads before the file expires. However, while Mozilla launched Firefox Send with the privacy and security of its users in mind since late 2019, Firefox Send has seen broader adoption in the malware community. In most cases, the use is usually the same. Malware authors upload malware payloads on Firefox Send. The file is stored in an encrypted format, and then hackers share the links inside emails they send to their targets. Over the past few months, Firefox Send has been used to store payloads for all sorts of cybercrime operations, from ransomware to financial crime, and from banking trojans to spyware used to target human rights defenders. A UK cybersecurity researcher took the time to describe some of the several features that have drawn malware authors to Firefox Send. For starters, Firefox URLs are natively trusted within organizations, meaning that email spam filters won't detect or even be configured to block Firefox Send URLs. Second, cybercrime gangs don't have to invest any of their own time and financial resources into putting together a file hosting infrastructure. They can just use Mozilla's servers. Third, Send encrypts data. hindering malware detection solutions, and download links can be configured to expire after a certain time or number of downloads, hindering incident response efforts. SEN also has a password protect feature, again making it easier to escape detection from perimeter devices. The rising number of malware operations abusing Firefox SEN has not escaped the cybersecurity community and the various malware hunting groups. For the past few months, security experts have complained about the lack of a report abuse mechanism or report file button they could use to take down malware operations that have abused the platform. Last month, security researchers filed a bug report on the Mozilla Bug Tracker, asking Mozilla to add a report abuse system. Mozilla surprised everyone and the cybersecurity community by taking a proactive approach and almost immediately suspending the entire Firefox SEN service while they worked to improve it. A Mozilla spokesperson said, "These reports are deeply concerning on multiple levels, and our organization is taking action to address them. We will temporarily take Firefox SEN offline while we make improvements to the product. Before relaunching, we will be adding an abuse reporting mechanism to augment the existing feedback form, and we will require all users wishing to share content using Firefox SEN to sign in with a Firefox account. We are carefully monitoring these developments and looking critically at any additional next steps." There were no timeline provided for Firefox SEN's return at this time, and any Firefox SEN links are now down, meaning that any malware operation relying on the service has also been thwarted. I've been using the service since last year to upload the Personal Computer Show program up to the studio, and now I have to find an alternate method of sending the file, because the broadcast material is a pretty large file in order to maintain high broadcast quality. Studies show security cameras can tell burglars when you're not home. Some popular home security cameras could allow would-be burglars to figure out when you left the house, according to a published study. Researchers found they could tell if someone was in and even what they were doing in the home just by looking at data uploaded by the camera and without monitoring the video footage itself. The international study was carried out by researchers from Queen Mary University of London and the Chinese Academy of Science, using data provided by a large Chinese manufacturer of Internet Protocol security cameras. Cameras like these allow users to monitor their homes remotely via a video feed on the Internet. But the researchers say the traffic generated by the devices can reveal privacy-compromising information. Popular security cameras such as those manufactured by Nest present the same privacy risk. The published study said that data uploads of the unencrypted data increase when a camera is recording something moving, so an attacker could tell that a camera was uploading footage of someone in motion and even different types of motion like running or sitting. The risk is that someone who is specifically targeting an individual household can be outside with a device to try and start passively monitoring traffic. An attacker would require a decent level of technical knowledge to monitor the data themselves, but there is a chance that someone could develop a program that does so and sell it online. Noting that there hasn't been any direct evidence of this kind of attack taking place, but one potential use would be if someone wanted to burglarize your home. They can monitor camera traffic over an extended period of time, and by looking at the patterns that are generated by those cameras over maybe a week, they then start predicting the following week when you're most likely to be in the house. In order to reduce the privacy risk, companies could randomly inject data into their systems to make it harder for attackers to spot a pattern. Under study is research to work out how to maintain camera performance while reducing privacy risk. At present, cameras are fairly stupid items in order to keep manufacturing costs down, and it is uploading data whenever motion is detected. What we need now is to have a more intelligent system that allow cameras to understand what that motion is, assess the level of risk, and intelligently upload the data when it's necessary to do so. For example, someone who owns a cat probably doesn't want to be alerted every time a camera detects the animal walking around, but they would certainly want to know if a human intruder was spotted. This is the first study to investigate the risk posed by video streaming traffic generated by the cameras. The global market for the devices is expected to be worth $1.3 billion by 2023, and popular brands include Xiaomi and Nest, which is owned by Google. While the study authors did not analyze data from those brands, they did find that their camera present the same privacy risk. The study was published at the IEEE International Conference on Computer Communications, which brings together researchers in networking and related fields. There was a news headline titled, "Google is replacing some Android apps for Chromebooks with progressive web apps," or otherwise known as TWAs. A progressive web app is essentially a web page that looks and feels like a traditional app. Isn't that what a Chrome app is? In some cases, PWAs are faster and more functional than their Android counterparts. PWAs also take up less storage and require less power to run. From then on, the PWA will function just like the Twitter app did. You see the icon in your app tray, you can set up push notifications, and you'll be able to uninstall it from the Play Store as well. How does the Chromebook app differ from a PWA? Just the format. Which leads to the question of Google versus Google Chrome. There is a difference between Google and Google Chrome. Google Chrome is a web browser, the tool you use to view sites on the internet. Google Chrome is used for the same thing as Safari, Microsoft Edge, and Firefox. Meanwhile, Google is the company that makes the Chrome browser. Commonly, though, when people think of Google, you're thinking of Google.com, the search engine. Aha, you see, there's a difference. More importantly, you can use Google as your search engine in other browsers like Edge and Safari. You do not need Google Chrome to use Google Search. Similarly, just because you're using Google Chrome does not mean your searches will always go through Google Search. Are you now totally confused? The product names given by Google can be the same word, but has a different definition when used as a noun or a verb. I can be talking about Google the company, which is then a noun. I can also say I will Google the internet for the best price of a certain product. In this instance, it is a verb. To make it more confusing, Google is a subsidiary of a company, Alphabet. But like most people, we refer to Google the company. I think they do this deliberately to confuse us senior citizens. I have a good friend who has been blessed with over a dozen grandchildren. I ask if he can remember the names. He said he had no problem. When he calls out, he just says, "Sweetheart." I only wish there was an audible sound for a smiling emoji. Hey, someone will come up with it. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. With people working at home, their dress code is different. Benjamin will talk about dress code versus standard business wear.
It's time to put on the business suit for me, Benjamin Rockwell, to bring you my business experience, my IT experience, 30 years, three decades of doing this. And this is actually going to, I'm going to stray a little bit outside of the business realm. It's still in the business world. It's just not so much IT. I'm going to talk about dress codes. And specifically, we're going to get into the IT dress code versus the standard business dress code. And I'm going to tell a story, actually. We'll start off with back, this is a little over two decades ago. I was interviewing for an assistant, and I had dressed in a suit, which was customary for the business that we were in. And I had gone to a location, a third-party location, to interview people because I did not want to do the interviews in the office. I did not want to give any kind of warning signs to the person who I was going to replace. No offense. Sorry, guy. So I'm sitting there in this restaurant, and somebody shows up, And he is dressed ultra casual. Jeans and a t-shirt. And I'm thinking, this can't be my interviewee. This cannot be the person who I'm going to interview for this position. He introduced himself. He was, oh boy. And I confronted him on this. And it was very interesting, the response that he had. Because the response he had was even more disconcerting. Especially since he said, well, this is how all IT professionals dress. If you're not aware of that, you don't know anything about IT. You're just a big pencil pusher. Wow. I dismissed him right away. I said, I assure you I'll run rings around you. I'm hiring you to be my assistant. You don't call me a pencil pusher. Especially since, anyways, I was taken aback, and I started to reflect on the fact that, yes, in IT, there are a number of things we do that are different from the standard dress code. Yes, we will wander around, and we will wear polo shirts that have logos, not from the company we are working for, but from some bizarre software company, hardware company, networking company, whatever it is. We have a lot of those, and a lot of t-shirts that have the same kind of thing going. And that's actually tolerated. It's allowed by the businesses, even in a place where you typically have a more business attire setup, which, one may argue that that may be completely going away with how comfortable we've been over the course of the recent months wearing our bunny slippers at home and all of that. But I hope you've got the idea that's going on here. IT is always kind of pushed that envelope of being more casual. And there's a few different reasons why. We hire these nerds, these brains, to come on in and to work on servers. I don't know if you've ever been in a server room. There are two competing factors that are happening here. One, you're in a server room. You are doing a lot of physical things. Yes, the server room may be a matter of 60, 65, 70 degrees. A few degrees to 10 degrees, even 20 degrees cooler than the office is. And we're lugging around big, huge servers. We are also putting our arms into various panels and various server racks and raised flooring, and we are pulling our arm out, and we hopefully have the right cable, but we also wind up tearing our shirts, or we wind up getting all sweaty, or we get there's a number of different things that happen along the way. I won't deny that on the work floor, in the server room, there are some hazards that can confront an IT professional. I will note, I'll go back, actually, one of the first positions I had was as a field technician. And I was warned, if you are working on any laser printers, actually any printers whatsoever, take off your tie. Take off my tie? Why? Because that tie can get caught up in the workings of that printer, and it can wind up pulling you down and hurting you and trapping you and worse. So, yeah, there was a certain level of making sure that everything was safe. Now, that doesn't apply all the way across. IT, however, has continued in that direction. I've worked in a number of different companies which were in the financial industry, and people around me, because they were not in IT, were dressed a little bit more upscale. They were wearing dress shirts and ties and sometimes suits. And that's all fine and dandy. That's all good. However, IT themselves didn't quite get that same memo. It's okay. I kind of crossed the middle of that boundary. I will wear button-down shirts. I may have them untucked, but I wear button-down shirts versus the t-shirts and the polo shirts. And I don't wear jeans to the office, and I always wear dress shoes. I don't believe in wearing sneakers. Don't get me wrong. The dress shoes I wear are almost like sneakers. They look like dress shoes, but they are built with an entire sneaker structure, and I enjoy them. Yeah, but that's another story for another day. It's just part of what I talk about here. But anyways, it's interesting how the IT dress code is actually also starting to affect the standard business dress code. We'll see how things continue to evolve in the coming years. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Today is July the 15th. And we are in the final hours of the approaching deadline to file our income tax returns. This is a post-event review of two tax prep programs. I, like many, have been using TurboTax to prepare my returns. Like creatures of habit, I have been using the same product because of, well, familiarity. Over the years, Intuit, which is the parent company of TurboTax, has been pushing the limits of their agreement with the United States Internal Revenue Service. The original agreement was that they would make available TurboTax as a free program for all those earning less than $69,000 a year, and the United States Internal Revenue Service, in turn, would not develop a tax preparation program for the masses. The IRS free file program delivered by TurboTax is supposed to be subject to adjusted gross income regardless of the tax return complexity. Like all agreements, there are different interpretations of what was agreed. One of the ways Intuit identified when the product was no longer free was by having selected schedules available only on the paid versions. So what is free from TurboTax today? What is free is if you have adjusted gross income of $36,000 or less, or you are on active military duty with a family income of $69,000 or less, or you qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit. The IRS announced that its free file program is now available at www.irs.gov. The IRS free file program is a public-private partnership that provides free tax preparation and filing services for eligible taxpayers at no cost to the taxpayer or the government. As a founding member of the Free File Alliance, Intuit is to provide free tax preparation to millions of Americans. Last year, there were 238 million tax returns filed. Only 1.2 million taxpayers filed using the TurboTax IRS Free File offer. That's just a small drop in the bucket. This year, taxpayers with an adjusted gross income of $36,000 or less, or military personnel, including the National Guard and Reserves, with adjusted gross income of $69,000 or less, or those who qualify for Earned Income Tax Credit, can prepare and file their federal and state tax returns for free with the IRS Free File Program delivered by TurboTax. TurboTax makes its free file program offering available to the maximum number of eligible taxpayers allowed by the IRS. Other taxpayers with an adjusted gross income of $69,000 or less may visit irs.gov to find offers from other providers as well that may have less stringent limitations. To summarize, median household income in the United States is $63,030, which means about half of households are qualified to use a free version of TurboTax. But this is all just background noise to what I'm driving at. If you owe money on the return, you hold off filing until the last minute, as you have had use of funds interest-free from the government. Of course, if you're expecting a refund, you file as early as possible, since the government has had the use of your money interest-free. But if you're going to file late, don't wait for the last minute to prepare your taxes. Many do have their return ready to go in the final week of the due date. Being ready to go means there are no errors in the review of the return that was prepared. What has happened in the past years is TurboTax has notified people that some of the returns are waiting for a finalized return form. There is a frustration that is growing that some of these returns cannot be updated by the due date approaching. The TurboTax workaround is simple. They tell people that although the form is not finalized, you can send it in manually instead of filing electronically. The IRS and the state tax agencies will still accept your return. When you tell them New York State only wants an electronic return, we're told that they will accept it manually. Of course, they'll be charging you a fee of $25. But what has now happened is some have been getting clean reviews with no errors, and the tax return cannot be transmitted. Again, TurboTax workaround was to print the return and send it in manually. The assumption is it is a good return, and you shouldn't have to worry about any errors. I was in that position last week. I still had a week to go hoping that there would be an update to the forms in question, that I'll be able to have it so I can send it electronically. I've been getting email from Credit Karma of their free tax preparation program that is fully featured, that had absolutely no limits on what your income is. So I decided to see how this might work out. Manually entering the information into Credit Karma tax templates were relatively easy, as I already had my data organized for TurboTax and it was printed out. This tool took me about 2 hours to re-enter data and to verify that I had no errors. The whole process took less than a day. The big test was how do these two programs might differ in results. With TurboTax, I entered the data to the exact penny. I did the same for Credit Karma. TurboTax retained my original data to the penny as Credit Karma rounded the numbers to the nearest dollar. The final result was a $1 difference in my expected refund. But before getting to the final numbers, I had a difference of $16 with Form 8995 on foreign tax paid. Credit Karma is an online program, and they had the finalized form online. TurboTax, on the other hand, using the older form, missed the change. For those who have filed for a tax extension, try using the free version of TurboTax or Credit Karma if you have anything more than a simple return. Part of all this problem is the government goes through kabuki theater with any legislation. I have a suggestion. For each day the IRS needs in the following year to finalize the tax forms, the deadline of April 15 should be extended for the same amount of time. So, how does Credit Karma tax preparation program compare to Intuit TurboTax? My tax return, when prepared with TurboTax, with all the official forms and all the calculation worksheets, generated a 118-page PDF report. The actual return itself was 14 pages, which included the voucher payment forms. I would call this overkill in how to take a simple report and generate a book report. The bulk of the report was boilerplate material published by the federal and state tax departments. The TurboTax generated report included information of interest but not relevant to the return, such as estimated tax options, 2-year comparison, 5-year tax history, tax summary, and how your return compares to U.S. averages. Credit Karma kept it simple with the same 14 pages. I prefer to have the full report, however. If audited, I would have all the calculation worksheets, and I would not have to rummage through for the electronic file and have it printed out for the audit. Because I had minimum distribution requirements and retirement distributions, I needed the TurboTax Home and Finance version of TurboTax. This version is not available online. Credit Karma, tax preparation program, on the other hand, is one size fits all and is only available online. It is free, but your data sits in the cloud. I have a personal preference to prepare my tax return on my computer, not connected to the cloud for any processing. I guess it's just my distrust for data security in the cloud. No companies, no matter how small or big, are immune to cyber attacks. This time, TurboTax met all my requirements except one. I need to be able to file electronically. When I could not transmit for whatever the reasons may be, I have to use an alternate product. Credit Karma is full feature, providing the basic services for filing a return. It is only available online. I just had to accept the fact that I had no choice but to use cloud services this time around. Presenting Marty Winston with All Hands on Tech. The ads and the press releases may seem compelling. Adding one more feature to your HVAC system and gain some remarkable benefits, well, it may not really be there. Marty says some HVAC improvements do raise suspicions.
HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, HVAC. Maybe it should also stand for have vigilance against cons. Okay, maybe not cons so much, but what do you call it when you get talked into adding something expensive that causes more problems than it solves? And the trickiest question of all, until you've already bought it and used it for a while, like, for example, until at least a day or two past the end of its warranty, how do you know what evil lurks as a result of turning it on? You know what? Sometimes you don't have to wait for the warranty to be up. Sometimes the harm it does is because it's still operating, not because it fails. There's a veteran HVAC guy who's been very helpful for decades in terms of our understanding of the street smarts of HVAC, and he paid us a visit to talk about, well, things that their name brand manufacturers explained as best-in-class wonderful, but that don't have such a brilliant shining record in real life. You won't hear any product or brand names, but you will hear some carefully identified technologies named. We moved into this 41-year-old house last year, bringing with us a collection of HVAC products that all reviewed well. Of course, a test bench review only involves a limited usage period, and some of these products are okay, and some of them have unannounced consequences. Let's get down to cases. In an arid climate, or in any climate with a winter, things can get dry and it can be healthier to humidify. Humidifiers can be as simple as a wet towel over the back of a chair. In-room plug-in humidifiers are relatively inexpensive. But attaching a humidifier on a water line to the HVAC system allows assured whole house humidification, all under the control of a humidity sensor, usually in a control that mounts near the whole house unit, but sometimes, well, something like a smart thermostat could also take that humidifier under its control. There are a few ways that a central humidifier does its work. The most popular designs run more or less a sheet of water down an open panel that lets air through, all placed in a small jumper duct to redirect some of the return airflow that's coming back from the rooms through the jumper duct and into the air handler where it gets blown through the ductwork and out into the rooms. A leading vendor in the category recommended kicking things up a notch to a unit that heats the water to turn it into steam, so that it's steam being injected into the blown air, with a list of benefits for doing it that way. The HVAC pro nixed that. He said, "You've never seen ductwork get so rusted out so quickly." He recommended a much more modest unit scaled to the size of the house and skipping the steam. So that steam humidifier is now ready to have Habitat for Humanity pick it up. Then there's the air filter. An HVAC system needs something in the path between the return airflow from the rooms and the air handler where conditioned air gets blown down the ductwork. Pleated fabric filters work fine. Years ago, the same pro recommended not getting bamboozled into buying filters rated for allergen protection if no one in the house has allergies. For a while, we went with MERV 6, that's a filter rating. The lower the number, the bigger the paths through the filter for things in the air, but also the freer the air flows. So the lower the energy usage and the less wear and tear you get on the system. MERV 6 lets almost everything through except clumped dust. A MERV 8 filter is a little tighter, still free flowing, and still inexpensive. Also a little easier to find these days than MERV 6. That was MERV 8. A MERV 11 filter stops a lot of stuff, and its pass-through is as tight as most people will ever want to go. Oh, yeah, there are tighter filters, MERV 16 and HEPA, and some special series. But for most HVAC systems, those are really asking for trouble. They put so much resistance in the air path that an HVAC is forced to run much longer to reach its heating or cooling targets. Ironically, it won't have to run very long at all to cost you a ton of money. If your HVAC system wasn't designed from scratch for those extreme filters, the back pressure has a track record of destroying major parts of HVAC systems. Don't even think about how expensive that's going to be. But let's kick that up a notch. We had in our hands a replacement to go in where the filter box sits. The replacement combined a standard fabric filter with an electrostatic filter. The electrostatics attract dust to a charged plate and pull it out of the airflow. Great theory. But the real-life units, as our very experienced pro told us, have a track record of the electrostatic elements punching holes in the filters and destroying themselves. So, yes, that too is going to Habitat for Humanity instead of getting installed here. This old house has an air conditioner and a gas furnace, not a heat pump. It's on a hilltop in the maple sugar woodlands of northeast Ohio, right in the blizzard belt. Extreme cold is no stranger here, and it's important for you to know how heat pumps work in extreme cold. As the weather cools down into the 30s, a heat pump works like an air conditioner in reverse, pumping cold air out of the outdoor unit and blowing warmed air into the house. In fact, no matter how cold it gets outside, there is no temperature at which it isn't blowing warm air into the house. It just starts getting a lot less effective. There isn't enough warmth to overcome the cold. That's why heat pumps get built with booster heat. It's usually a resistive electric heating element, like in a toaster or an electric oven or an electric space heater. If you're outside when it kicks in, you might hear a little voice inside your electric meter saying,
"Warp 3, aye, Captain,"
as the meter starts spinning at seldom seen speeds. Sometimes heat pumps use gas for booster heat, but the way that works tends to make too much heat at once. So it turns on and makes the house a little too hot, turns off and the house gets a little too cold, and the indoor temperature keeps yo-yoing back and forth that way. Some systems use hydronics, meaning hot water loops. Depending on the size of the house and the nature of the hot water supply, that may be enough or maybe not quite enough. And in either case, you'll soon find out if your hot water system is big enough to let you also take long warm showers or wash clothes when the house needs that heat boost. A separate furnace does a much better job of heating the house quickly and maintaining its temperature within closer tolerances. So when the idea of converting to a heat pump came up, the HVAC pros said, "Nope, you'd be sorry." So how about a dehumidifier? One of the boxes we moved has a new 90 pint per day unit that was planned for the attic, but our HVAC pro talked us into installing it in the basement right next to the other HVAC gear, where short jumper ducts could let it take full advantage of the ventilation system and more efficiently treat the whole house. That work happens in 2 weeks. We're also installing a 4-lamp UVC disinfecting array within the return air trunk duct, just above, slightly offset from its drop into the HVAC system. That's a carefully chosen position where the UVC can directly expose all the returned air from above while directly shining on absolutely nothing below. UVC, you see, can degrade plastics and some other materials, so you place it to protect such things. In our recent segment on electrostatic air treatment, you heard our plan to have 2 units, one in the return air duct before the filter and a second one in the air handler after the filter. That plan changed. There will be just 1 in the air handler where the charged air mass can treat the entire run of ductwork and get into the rooms. Charged air clumps up whatever's in the air, and some of that gets into the return air path through the cold air return registers. And if that air includes any viable infectious microorganisms, those will get neutralized by the UVC kill array before the filter, and even a modest filter can trap those clustered clumps. A second electrostatic gizmo is unnecessary. We'll soon start replacing the round metal ductwork in the basement ceiling with insulated flexible round ductwork, as much for reducing noise as for reducing thermal losses, but that will be its own tale. as will whatever we decide to do with the rumbling metal faces of the big rectangular trunk ducts. At least we won't have to replace long runs of prematurely rusted ducts or regret the cost of the sheet metal work that installing the self-destructing electrostatic filter would have meant, or dealing with sweaters and fireplaces while a heat pump surrenders to environmental frigidity. Next time, in a ceiling space that has to dodge the ducts, you'll share our hands-on experience with wiring LED fixtures for one of the most widely used brightness control standards, one called 0 to 10 volt dimming. Parts of it are extremely simple, parts a little gnarly. Have you worked much with three-way switches when dimming also has to happen? 0 to 10 volt lighting control next time. It beats working in the dark.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. And if you're interested in the subject itself, RSVP so you can get a meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, July the 23rd. Starting at 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. A tutorial on Google Docs. For some who may not know, Google Docs is a word processor included as part of a free web-based software office suite offered by Google within its Google Drive service. This service also includes Google Sheets and Google Slides, a spreadsheet and presentation program respectively. Their website is bcug.com for the Zoom meeting ID. The Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, July the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom, and you can go to their website, ppcug-nj.org, and RSVP to get a meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, August the 13th. At 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is How to Set Up RetroPie on the Raspberry Pi. RetroPie on the Raspberry Pi, a combination of many emulation projects bundled into one system which is built on top of the Raspbian OS. Emulation Station essentially acts as the front end for a bunch of independently designed emulators, and you can play a lot of the old-fashioned games on this. RSVP at nyacc.org if you're interested for a Zoom meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 11th, and their meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information on how to get onto Amazon, RSVP to acgnj.org for more information on how you can participate via Amazon Chime. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.